good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. Still not altogether myself as far as my voice is concerned. If you're a regular listener, you know this is not how I usually sound, but I do have a touch of laryngitis that I've been enduring since Monday. However, if you've been listening every day, you may be able to tell, or maybe you can't, but I can, that it is getting better. So each day it's getting better, and hopefully by maybe beginning of next week we'll be back to normal. In the meantime, the program is normal. We still are taking phone calls. I will be glad to talk to you if you want to call me at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090, and you can call if you have questions about the Bible or about Christianity, or if you have an alternate viewpoint you'd like to present. We have a couple of callers that have been waiting online since, for a while before the program went on the air. But we have also lines open at 1-800-438-5090. First caller today is Ben from Dexter, Oregon. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. I think I called last week or something. I don't remember the day, but it was about Ephesians chapter 1 and Paul's use of the terms us and we in the first 12 verses, and then after that he switches to you in referring to, I guess, the blessings that God has given. You remember that?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we've been thinking a lot about it, and you had told me that some of the different options out there where he was either referring to like a Jew-Gentile split, like in the first 12 verses, maybe talking about the Jews and then Gentiles after that, or maybe talking about the apostles versus the converts over in Ephesus or wherever he was writing. And I was trying to think about how those things would fit together. And if it was talking about the Jew-Gentile thing, which seems like it's a pretty big theme in his letter, I was just curious about the phrase adopted, that God adopted us. It just seems like would they think of it that way, being Jews, or would they think of themselves more as a natural son and Gentiles being the ones adopted? Or even if he was talking about apostles, like them as apostles, how would the term adopted fit in that way in their thinking? And if you could just talk about that a little bit, I'd appreciate it.
Well, whether it's talking about the Jew-Gentile distinction or apostles and other people distinction, it does not mean that the things he says in verses 1 through 12 would only apply to the group he's referring to. I think that what he would be saying in those verses is primarily applicable to all Christians. Why he mentions himself and others like him first, I don't know. In fact, it's entirely possible that he does not necessarily mean for there to be a distinction between the we and the you, because although, it does appear in the text that he says we sometimes and you sometimes, it's not entirely impossible for him to mean all Christians in any case. In other words, we could simply mean anyone who became Christians before the Ephesians did, and therefore all Christians, including the Ephesians at verse 13, where he says, you also, came into this situation with us.
It is a kind of a generic letter, so that would make sense. I mean, if he wasn't specifically even talking to the Ephesian church, if it was just kind of a generic letter, even if he was talking to the Ephesian church, it would be, that could be true. But in what sense wouldn't in a Jewish mind, I don't know, would they consider themselves adopted into God's family, or how does that work?
Well, they probably would. If they consider themselves to be parts of God's family, it'd be through adoption. The Jews would not believe that they were born of God, as we believe we are, actually. And being born again, being born of God, is something the Jews did not have in their self-image. In fact, when Jesus said that God was his father, the Jews took up stones to stone him because they considered that blasphemy. So the Jews would not generally think of themselves as sons of God. And if they did, they would be thinking in terms of adoption rather than natural birth.
I guess with the way like Paul talks about like the natural tree and the Gentiles being grafted in, I guess I don't know why. I always had it in my head, like Gentiles being adopted into a family that already existed. You know, I don't know. That's probably just something I picked up along the line that needs to go.
Well, you know, all of us have been adopted into God's family, but also in the New Covenant, we've been born as children of God in another sense. So, I mean, both images seem to work in the New Testament. I don't know if the Old Testament Jews would think of themselves as a family of with God as their father very commonly.
Okay. Well, I mean,
they thought of Abraham as their father.
Right. That's true. But God does refer to Israel as far as like in the imagery of being a son in certain places. But that's more collectively.
Issue. Collectively. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, that's good. I don't know why that I got hung up on that, but I appreciate just your thoughts on that, and I'll think about it some more. Thank you.
Okay, Ben. Thanks for your call.
Bye.
Bye now. Our next call is from Michael from Live Oak, California. And we have a line open for you at 1-800-438-5090. Michael, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Oh, hi, Steve. How are you?
Well, my voice isn't very good, but I'm okay.
All right. So I had some thoughts about what we had talked about on Sunday. It should be fairly brief. And that is the Hindu / Buddhist teaching on rebirth or reincarnation. One of the distinguishing characteristics of that concept is that each person, that their destiny is not shaped so much by an external being, but rather by their own actions. So do you remember the story of the Christmas Carol where...
Dickens' story? Yeah.
And that first spirit of Christmas passed, I guess... Oh, no, it was actually his business partner came back and he was in chains and he said, I had these chains I created link by link, and if you wish to not suffer the same fate, then you will change. That was the beginning of his conversion process.
You know, okay.
The visitations from the different spirits. And so how somebody is at any given time is a result of what they've thought, said, and done in the past, and so that has molded their being, their experience of life as an individual, and of course that's understood as occurring in a person's present lifetime as well as from life to life. So it's more dependent upon the person's own volition over time rather than an external influence as would be understood in the Judeo-Christian concept of God.
In other words, under the karmic rule, you basically work out your own salvation by self-improvement, whereas in Christianity, you receive grace from God even though you don't deserve it.
Well, I wasn't referring to the issue of salvation so much.
Well, you were talking about being born again.
Right, but I was referencing it more in terms of that someone's, like we were talking about the range of conditions that people are born into, and
yes.
And then that the teaching of karma offers some explanation, as difficult as that is to fathom. At least it gives some reasons why someone would be born poor or rich or...
Right, but isn't that the point that I brought up about karma when we were talking about it before? And that is that if karma is true, then the miserable conditions that some people are born into are conditions that they have deserved because of choices they made in a previous lifetime. And if that is true, that does not really give a very much incentive to help them in their misery, because if karma is requiring that they suffer for things they've done and we alleviate their suffering artificially, doesn't that mean that there's still some karmic debt that remains unpaid on their behalf and that they'll have to come back and do it again?
There's two aspects of that. One, the person who's offering the assistance, that's always going to be considered a positive thing if somebody helps someone.
But why? If the person who's being helped is actually experiencing a circumvention of karmic justice by the help.
It would be positive for the person who's performing or who's offering the help. How it would affect the person who's receiving the help, it could potentially inspire them to, they could be so touched by that it could help them spiritually and inspire
It might make them behave better and acquire more good karma.
It might be a positive influence, which would be an incentive to live in
Okay, I think I see your point, which would be that even if a person is born in miserable condition because of a karmic debt that is accruing to them, if somebody would show them kindness and mercy, it might awaken that miserable person to the need for such goodness, to the beauty of such goodness,
right,
and inspire them to live a better way,
right,
and so that they themselves might counteract the karmic debt.
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
Okay, I understand your point, I think.
So, but... The main point being that according to the teachings on this, one's destiny, the primary determining factor is one's own volitional activities because otherwise. It's very hard to fathom why people would be so different, why they would have different characteristics, and why the conditions of people's station.
Michael?
Yeah.
Do you find that the idea of karma and reincarnation is more attractive than the Christian view?
Well, again, I don't even know if the original Christian view... That may or may not have had.
Well, let's just say the view that Jesus taught, since I consider that the original Christian view, the view that's found in the teaching of Jesus.
Which you're saying is that there's only one life.
Right, and that after you've died, you will go into the grave, but at the resurrection, all who are in the graves will come out and be judged and be rewarded for what they've done.
It's hard. It's a hard pill for me to swallow because, that people would have such differing situations that are what they're born into.
But what you're assuming is no matter what condition people were born into, they'll be judged by the same severe standard, and that therefore that doesn't seem fair. What I'm suggesting is that God will judge everyone justly, so that if they had few advantages and few opportunities, they will be judged very lightly by comparison to those who had many opportunities and neglected them. So, in other words, karma and reincarnation, just, you know, no matter how bad you are, you always get another chance to go through life and suffer some more and, you know, to get it right. But you're always going to come back to this world until you reach nirvana, I suppose.
Well, not exactly,
why would that be in any sense more acceptable to our conscience than the idea of a benevolent God who justly and benevolently assesses everybody's life based on the opportunities they had and what they did with them, and rewards them accordingly? Why would that be a harder pill to swallow?
Because how could a benevolent God give rise to beings that have experienced such just inconceivable suffering? You know, we don't have to look very far, in different, even within this country and other countries. I mean, really, really. The horrendous conditions, and
Michael, I mean, everyone suffers more than they wish they did. Even those who suffer very little suffer less, more than they wish they did, and then those who suffer a great deal often endure it much more amazingly than they would have thought they could. It's hard to say what degree of suffering would be necessary in order to justify ruling out a benevolent God. If a person who has suffered a very great deal, let's say like Richard Wurmbrand, who was tortured for 14 years in communist prisons for nothing but being a Christian, or many other Christians who've suffered similarly, if he can come out and say, you know, suffering was very good for me, I really benefited from that, well then, what amount of suffering could we look at and say, no one could benefit from that? If we're going to say that suffering is necessarily evil, then we have to be able to say that there is a degree of suffering from which a person who suffers it could never benefit and should not be expected to benefit. In my opinion, there is no such degree. No matter how much a person suffers, I believe they could conceivably benefit from it. And I have not suffered as much as many have, but I have suffered more than some. And I would say this, that I don't begrudge the sufferings I've been through, and I wouldn't be surprised if I had more ahead of me. But in any case, no matter how much suffering I go through, it would never cause me to wonder, is God benevolent? Because I happen to know that suffering is something that can be used for my benefit. And therefore, if I already believe on other grounds that there is a benevolent God, then I interpret my sufferings through that grid. Now, what you're assuming, I think, is that a lot of people suffer needlessly and innocently and never have a chance to benefit from it. And then God, you know, sends them to hell because they never heard about Jesus. And that does sound unjust. I will agree with you about that. But I don't know that that scenario is real. I believe that everybody who suffers, everybody, has the opportunity to turn to God in their suffering, even if they've never heard of Him. I believe that people intuitively know there's a God until they decide that there isn't one. And if people would turn to God, as many millions of people have in their suffering, then their suffering can be to their benefit. And if their suffering proves to be to their benefit, spiritually, then it becomes difficult to say that such suffering is inconsistent with the plans of a benevolent God.
Well, just the fact that there are such differences in people's conditions of birth, I mean,
Yeah.
So
what? That's the differences in people's conditions of birth are simply one part of the whole picture of differences in suffering and differences in advantage and so forth. But what does that have to do with the justice of God, who will not judge anyone unjustly? In other words, if a person has a disadvantageous birth circumstance, God knows, and God will take that into consideration when he judges. So why should that be, why should that reflect negatively on God?
Well, all I'm saying is that the notion of karma at least offers an explanation as to why there would be these different conditions of birth. Otherwise, it's very hard to fathom why, you know, someone would be born very poor in a place where there's little opportunity to even hear about spiritual, hear any spiritual teachings.
Well, see, I don't believe that being, I don't believe that having a certain standard of living has any relationship at all to being able to think about spiritual things. I believe, in fact, that those people who are the poorest are the ones most likely to turn their attention to things that are within their reach when material comfort is not within their reach.
Well, but so some people, they're probably so consumed by hunger and fear that there's just no space. You know, there's just no. They never have any relief from all of that, so that there's not even the possibility of thinking beyond.
But Michael, hunger and fear are two of the things that actually turn many people's thoughts to God more than other things do. Many people turn to God when they're afraid, even when they're atheists. You know, when they're afraid, they say, okay, God, you know, if you get me out of this, I'll serve you, even though they're atheists and at other times profess not to believe in God. So I believe that fear, living in fear, which many people do, as much as I pity them, and I do not enjoy fear myself, I don't think that we can say that it has that it prevents people from turning to God. Likewise, hunger. Many spiritual people use hunger through fasting as a means of turning their thoughts more toward God and spiritual things. So I don't think that physical hunger, physical danger, physical pain, I don't think any of those things in themselves tend to turn people from God. I think it's a person's own choice to turn to God or not in his circumstances, whether they're good or bad.
But the very fact that some would have to experience that, and others have lives of relative leisure and peace, it just doesn't seem fair. Without the explanation offered by the teaching of karma,
yeah,
what would be the causal factors for that? It seems rather random, and it doesn't seem.
You know, Jesus told a parable about a rich man who was going on a long journey, and he called some of his servants, and he wanted to entrust them with the management of his goods. And he gave one of his servants just one share in the goods. Another servant, he gave two shares in the goods, and another servant, he gave five shares. Now, that certainly does reflect the way things are in real life, that God has not given us all the same advantages. He's not given us all the same responsibility either. And with the greater share comes the greater responsibility. Now, the man who received only one share, he might wonder why he received only one share, but it doesn't seem appropriate to say, well, the master who gave him only one share had no good reason for that. We might say when the master was distributing his goods to different servants for management, he had something in mind. He had something that guided his choices. The servant who received a large share or a small share doesn't know what guided his master in making the choice. But there's certainly nothing absurd about the master distributing things not equally.
Well,
the master might have very good reasons.
According to their abilities, I guess.
Actually, that is what is said there. Now, also, you talk as if earthly comfort and earthly prosperity are advantages, spiritually speaking. And Jesus said they're not. Jesus said it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. And he said, blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. And it says in James that God has chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom, which God has promised to those who love him. So if that is true, then being born into humble circumstances may be the biggest blessing, because being born into rich and comfortable circumstances may incur those difficulties that Jesus spoke of that prevent many from coming to God at all. So we might have it all backward. We might say, well, how does God justify, some people being born comfortable and some people being born miserable? Well, the hardest thing to justify is, why does he have anyone born comfortable? Since the comfortableness, it can be a deterrent to their eternal happiness.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, but it doesn't have to be. Some people, when they see the blessings God's given them, respond in thankfulness and serve him. You see, a person's response to God is not determined by his circumstances. There are people in prison who worship God, and there are people in penthouses who ignore God. And therefore, to present some kind of a challenge to God's justice in the scenario that some people are born poor and some are born rich, it's not a challenge to God's justice. It simply is that God is giving different people different tests. Poverty is one kind of test. Riches are another kind of test. More people pass the spiritual test of poverty than pass the spiritual test of riches.
You're saying people are souls come into the world that they're blank slates, that they're born into these different conditions, and everybody has their test, and you know that people, that the different souls would have vastly different tasks or different tests to pass, things to get through, and then to turn to God. I mean, that's more difficult for me to accept than the classical.
Okay. Well, Michael, you and I have been talking for years, and it's obvious that there are some things that I believe are difficult for you to accept. I would find karma and reincarnation more difficult to accept for one very important reason, and that is that Jesus taught otherwise, and I don't know anybody who has the status of Jesus who taught that those things are true. I don't know of anyone who was God come down in the flesh who taught those things. So I would trust Jesus over anyone else. You are in a different position than I am because you don't trust Jesus above all others. And because of that, you will probably remain a Buddhist for a long time, and you will find difficult to believe what Christians believe. But I would be glad to converse more about this with you, but I have other calls waiting.
That's fine, Steve. All right, we'll talk again. Thank you very much.
Okay, Michael. Good talking to you.
Same here. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Jeremiah from Portland, Oregon. And if you'd like to be on the program, you're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. I have laryngitis, but we're still doing the broadcast. You can still call in. If you have questions about the Bible or disagreements with the host, feel free to call. It's 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Jeremiah, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for hosting the show today.
Sure.
Hey, I had a question about like types and shadows in the Old Testament and their fulfillment in the New. And it's about hell. I know we've talked about hell in the past. But would you say like most of the times, like it seems to me the types and shadows in the Old Testament, their fulfillment in the New is increased, or the fulfillment's greater than the type or the shadow? And I don't know if in regards to the doctrine of hell as this relates to it, maybe a case, or maybe it's a good case or not, or an argument for a side of eternal punishment. But if the Old Testament Hades is spoken of and referred to as a place where the fire is not quenched and the worm dieth not, and that's the Old Testament concept of the afterlife or a type of a punishment, would the fulfillment of that type in shadow, being hell, being something different, would it be a good argument or something in favor for eternal punishment to say that the fulfillment of a type in shadow is usually something of greater significance, or and then it's not less than the type in shadow itself?
Okay, so let me rephrase your question.
Yeah.
The Old Testament types are inferior to the fulfillments of those types in the New Testament. And you are saying that the Old Testament passages about the fire that is not quenched and the worm that does not die in Isaiah 66 and of the burning brimstone in the streets and so forth in Isaiah 34, which are taken up and alluded to in Jesus' teaching. Now, you're saying that those Old Testament punishments, even if they are, let's say, natural punishments, not hell, if they are a type of hell, wouldn't hell be something worse than those things? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, when the fulfillment of a type and shadow or something, yes, like...
Okay, well, my thought is that those things are not a type and a shadow of hell. When Jesus makes reference to Gehenna, where the fire is not quenched and the worm does not die, I don't believe he's talking about hell. I believe he's using Gehenna the same way that the prophet Jeremiah used it. And Jeremiah, the prophet, used it of the punishment that was coming upon Jerusalem in 586 B.C. when the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem. He said that Gehenna, the Valley of Hinnom, would become the Valley of Slaughter, because of the abundance of dead corpses that would be thrown into it. And so the Valley of Hinnom, or Gehenna is what it's called in the Greek, was a reference to a valley outside Jerusalem which became filled with dead bodies, corpses of the slain who were killed in the Babylonian invasion of Jerusalem. That's how the prophet Jeremiah used the term. Now, when Jesus used it, I think he was not using it any differently than Jeremiah did. I think Jesus was talking about the fact that the Romans were going to come in and they were going to slaughter the Jews and destroy Jerusalem, just like the Babylonians had done in Jeremiah's day. And that those Jews who rejected Christ's message could look forward to being thrown into Gehenna, the Valley of Hinnom, just like Jeremiah talked about. That they would suffer, in other words, an ignoble end. They would not be buried, except maybe in mass graves. And this is what Gehenna represented, just the great slaughter of the people who would be killed when Jerusalem would be invaded.
But doesn't like Jesus elsewhere mention where he speaks of hell? I know that it's translated, it refers to Gehenna or Hades. But he speaks of more than just physical punishment.
Well, there's only one reason to think so, and that is because in one of the places where Jesus speaks of Gehenna, he says, do not fear those who can kill the body and can do no more, but fear him who can destroy the body and the soul in Gehenna. And so, because Jesus speaks of the destruction of the soul in addition to the body in connection with Gehenna, it could be argued that Gehenna is referring to something beyond physical death. But there's another way of seeing it. And that is that he's saying that he's talking to the disciples. He's not talking to non-Christians. He's talking to the disciples, and he's saying that don't be afraid of those who will kill you for your faith. In other words, don't be afraid to die faithful. Don't be afraid of those who will kill your body and they can't hurt your soul. But rather, you should be more afraid of being in this other class who are going to end up in Gehenna, because their bodies are dying, but their souls are lost also. Because it's not that Gehenna is the place of souls, but rather that those who are thrown in Gehenna are those whose bodies and souls are both destroyed. And that is, they've come under the judgment of God because they're wicked, and their souls are, and their bodies are both under God's judgment. And they end up with the corpses in Gehenna. Now, what Jesus would be saying then is that if you die faithful to God, then people have killed your body, but your soul is still intact. If you die under the judgment of God in Gehenna, then your body and your soul are both destroyed. Not because Gehenna destroyed the soul, but because the person who ends up in Gehenna is one who, by definition, their soul has been destroyed and is destroyed because of their rebellion against God. That's why they're in Gehenna. That's why they got thrown into the Valley of Hinnom. That's why they were there when Jerusalem succumbed to the Roman invasion. You see, the Christians left Jerusalem before the Romans invaded, and therefore the Christians were not subject to that horrible Holocaust and did not end up in the Valley of Hinnom. But the Jews who rejected Christ remained there, and many of them, of course, were slaughtered.
But you would acknowledge that there's been hundreds and thousands of Christians throughout the years who have died just a horrible physical death.
Yep.
So that doesn't. How does that really add up?
Well, it adds up this way. It's like when Jesus said, "What shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul?" Okay. Well, how do you lose your soul? You lose your soul by refusing to have a relationship with God, and so he's saying, you know, your earthly circumstances are nothing to be compared with your eternal circumstance or the state of your soul. And when he told his disciples, don't be afraid of those who only kill your body, they can't hurt your soul. Well, then it doesn't matter how horrendously Christians are tortured or how terribly they die. Their soul is still intact. Their soul is in good shape. And they are, they're better off than the person who has lost their soul and dies. You see, I don't think Jesus is contrasting the intensity of the death, the intensity of the pain in death in Gehenna. Many of the people who were thrown into Gehenna were probably killed instantly at sword point, or may have died in their sleep. So he's not saying Gehenna is necessarily, a more miserable place to go. But it is the place that people will go who have died under this particular judgment of God. And if you die under the judgment of God, then it's a given your soul is in bad shape. Your soul is not saved. God would not have judged you like that if you were one of his. So the focus is on what happens after death. But that doesn't mean that Gehenna is the place that people go after death. Their bodies can be thrown in Gehenna, and yet the fact that they are in Gehenna also bears testimony that their souls were lost, because only those who were lost were thrown into Gehenna. Only those who were lost remained in Jerusalem and were slaughtered because the Christians had fled. So anyway, I don't see a need to apply Gehenna there to the afterlife. Okay? Jeremiah, maybe you're not tracking with me, and that's okay. I do have other calls to take. You there? Well, it sounds like Jeremiah's not there. Okay, we'll just hang up on him and see if we can get a hold of Wayne. Oh, Wayne, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. How you doing, Steve? Sounds like you got a cold.
I do. Well, I have laryngitis, yeah.
Sorry to hear that, brother. Well, hope you get well quick. Hey, I was just curious. Have you ever read a book by Gaylord Enns called The Love Revolution?
No, I don't think I've heard of it.
Okay. Well, it's written by a pastor, and he sort of had a nervous breakdown, basically. He had a meltdown. He had to take a sabbatical, and it was, you know, sometime before he could, like, even crack the Bible again. And as he did, he started just asking God to kind of guide him and show him stuff. And the premise of the book is that he feels that the church kind of went off on a tangent way back, you know, shortly after the early church fathers. And what he meant by that was that he feels that church leaders somehow focused on Jesus' answer to the teacher of the law's question about what the greatest commandment was, and substituted the new covenant and new commandment, which Jesus gave, for that, which should never have taken place, because never again is that mentioned as the premise for, you know, for the new testament, for the new covenant, for the new life, by either Jesus or any of the, you know, the New Testament writers.
Yeah. So, now, we've got a lot of noise on your phone there. I mean, the dog is very loud. Maybe you could cover the mouthpiece. Let me see if I understand you. I don't think I understand what the premise is. You made a distinction between the great commandment, which is love your neighbor as you love yourself, on the one hand,
right,
and the command of Christ to love one another as I have loved you, on the
right.
other hand, and you're saying that one of those was never mentioned again. Was it the
right.
command of Christ that was never mentioned again?
Right. Well, because, you know, I mean, his premise is that, you know, the old covenant was instituted with law. There was, you know, laws came along with it. The Ten Commandments basically was when the old covenant was instituted, is what he's saying. And it was based on you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Whereas in the new covenant, the two things that we are commanded are to believe in the one that the Father sent, which is Jesus, and to love one another as he has loved us.
Yeah.
So it takes us out of the, you know, because we're not under the law anymore, but people, you know, he said, you know, the large majority of people that he's polled, you know, when they ask him, you know, what commandments or what things did Jesus tell us to obey in the New Testament, you know, what are the most important things? And they always go back to that answer that he gave to the teacher of the law instead of what he actually said was his commandment. He defined it as his commandment. A new commandment I give to you, love one another as I have loved you.
Yeah, but I don't know that he made a big distinction between that and the old commandment. I know there's a distinction, but I don't think it's a, I don't think it's that huge. And I do think that Paul, when he had the opportunity to quote Jesus' commandment on that, actually quoted the old great commandment in Romans chapter 13, because he says in Romans 13:8 and following, owe no one anything except to love one another. For he who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. And if there's any other commandment, are all summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. Now it's interesting, Paul said all the law is fulfilled in you shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. He could have said, all the law is fulfilled in Jesus' commandment, love one another as I have loved you. And it would be true also, because love is the ultimate fulfillment of all those laws. What I'm saying is that Paul, who certainly believed in the commandment that Jesus gave, didn't seem like he felt compelled to draw a big distinction between the old commandment to love your neighbors, you love yourself, which he here advocates, and the new commandment. I think the two are very similar.
Yeah. Yeah, he goes on to, you know, further to kind of clarify that, or talk about how John was the one who actually, out of all the New Testament writers, he's the only one that really wrote about, you know, gave the account of when Jesus instituted the new covenant and gave his new command, you know, at the Last Supper. And
yeah.
He talks about how in the new covenant, because God now resides within each one of us, that the commandment to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind and strength is actually fulfilled by us loving one another. And this is the sign to the world that we are the true church of God, that we love one another. And he's saying that, you know, because we kind of got that wrong and didn't understand that the fulfillment of loving God is now in loving our brothers and sisters in Christ. You know, there's a lot of kind of ugly church history that demonstrates anything but us loving one another.
Well, that's true. But, on the one hand, I agree with him. I think the church did get off track shortly after the apostles' time, and where they got off track was by removing the love obligation from the core of what it means to be a Christian. Instead, they began to define Christianity by creeds and by belief systems, where Jesus didn't do that. Jesus defined it by whether you love one another. But I'm not sure why this author is making the distinction so much between the Old Testament love commandment and the New Testament love commandment. I don't really see a big difference there.
Yeah. Now,
if he's saying that we only have to love one another and we don't have to love God because loving one another is loving God, well, he's got part of the truth there. Certainly, Jesus said, "Inasmuch as you've done it to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me." So loving people and loving God's people is a part of loving God. But that doesn't mean that you have no need to love God himself, even in the abstract. I mean, in other words, if the only time I have to love God is when I have people around me to love, well, then what about when I'm in isolation? What if I'm in solitary confinement? How do I love God then? Well, I can. I certainly can love God when I'm alone, because I love God personally also, God for who he is, and I worship him. But loving people is one, I guess, aspect of loving God. You love me, you love my dog. Love me, love my kids. You love God, you love his people. You love who he loves.
Well, okay, but what about this? He actually said that the converse is also true. It says you can't love God whom you have not seen if you don't love your brother whom you have seen.
I agree.
Right? So
I agree. If you don't love your brother, then you don't love God.
If you go through religious rituals, you know, I spend so many hours a day in prayer, I guess you could be doing that out of love for God. But you could also be doing it out of a sense of obligation with, you know, really just a fear motivation, you know, or a...
Well, yeah, but that's a different issue. I mean, whether we should love God or not is a different issue than
right.
whether we are praying out of love or out of some other motive.
Right. Can't do any of it without the Holy Spirit inside of us.
Yeah.
You know, human motivation does not achieve.
Yeah. Well, Wayne, I have not read that book. I had not heard of that author, and therefore I can't really interact with his specific arguments.
Yeah,
listen,
I can't really give you a...
Okay, I'm almost out of time, and I want to take another call, but I appreciate your call, brother.
All right. Well, I hope sometime you'll get your hands on it and take a look at it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, bye now. Our next caller, and the last one today, is Carolyn from Pacific Grove. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Steve. I have a question regarding where we are in Luke and not remembering what you had said probably in one of our studies. Luke 14, Jesus refers to what something Moses had said in the Old Testament regarding the cleansing of the leper.
Uh-huh.
He says, make an offering for your cleansing as a testimony to them, just as Moses commanded.
Yes.
Did you refer to that in Bible study? I missed it, probably. I'll take an answer off the air.
Okay, what is your question about it then?
Oh, where in the Old Testament is Jesus referring to when he makes that statement?
Okay.
Moses commanded?
Sure, I'll be glad to talk about that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks for your call. Yeah, that's Luke 5:14, when Jesus cleansed the leper. He charged him to tell no one, but to go and show yourself to the priest and make an offering for the cleansing as a testimony to them, just as Moses commanded. That's a reference back to Leviticus chapters 13 and 14. Two whole chapters in Leviticus are devoted to the treatment of lepers. And there in chapter 13, it tells how the priest is supposed to diagnose whether a person has leprosy or not. And chapter 14 goes on to extend this further. But if a leper recovers from leprosy, he would have to go back to the same priest, at least to a priest, because the priest is the one who declared him unclean. Basically, the priest was like the public health official, and he quarantined the leper. He diagnosed the leprosy and quarantined him. And the leper could not go back into society again until he went back to the priest. If, in fact, he had recovered from the leprosy, the priest was to examine him. And there's in Leviticus 13 and 14, there is extensive instructions about this. And if the leper is indeed cleansed, if he's well, then he's supposed to take a certain sacrifice, some birds and so forth, and sacrifice them. A certain ritual is given there, which is a symbolic ritual of him being set free from his uncleanness. So when Jesus cleansed the leper, although the man was clean, he could not just go back into public life or into his home even again until he had a clean bill of health. And the place to get that was from the high priest. And that's why Jesus sent him there. And he's referring back to Leviticus chapters 13 and 14. I'd like to take this next call, but I don't think we have time. It's Brad from Paradise, California. And Brad, you know, we used to be on the air in Paradise, and we never got any calls from there, and we're not on the air anymore. But I hope you'll call tomorrow, because I would love to talk to you. The whistling in the background means that I don't have time to do justice to any calls. But Brad, please call back tomorrow. We will be on the air again, Lord willing, from 2 to 3. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. If you tuned in late, you might not think it's me, because my voice is so different today, and it's been all week I've had laryngitis. But I think it'll get better, and we're going to keep broadcasting even through and including New Year's Day. So every day this week we'll be live. We are a listener-supported ministry, and if you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Our website has a lot of resources which many people have found helpful. We have about 900 MP3 files of lectures of mine through the Bible and on many, many topics of practical interest to Christians. And these are all free. There's nothing for sale. You don't even have to sign up or give us your email address. You won't receive any spam from us. We don't have a mailing list. We don't send out anything. You just download it and use it. There's lots of stuff on our website. It's all free. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. And I hope you'll check it out, because there's a lot there you may benefit from. Till tomorrow, may God bless you. My name is Steve Gregg. We'll be on again, Lord willing, at 2 o'clock. We'll talk to you then.